Well, the headline nobody wanted to read today: mosquito invasion likely to last 2 weeks. Yuck. MSU entomologist Howard Russell in today's Lansing State Journal says the mosquitoes will be around as long as there is standing water. You can imagine how long that might be. He conjectures that there are still larvae developing in standing water. So that's, again, according to Mr. Russell, 10 days to maybe 2 weeks of mosquitoes. And that is assuming that there is less rain in the forecast. Certainly today, that is not the case. Welcome to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We learn more about this year's Michigan Shakespeare Festival later this hour. Also about the stunning $250,000 addition to the Impression 5 Science Center in Lansing, their water room. Peter Worf reports on that coming up in just a few minutes. At the top of our program, two members of our Michigan congressional delegation were in the Battle Creek area yesterday for a couple of site tours. Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow and Republican Congressman Fred Upton visited Fort Custer and the VA Medical Center in Battle Creek. Fort Custer is an Army training facility that's being looked at as a potential missile defense site. And Current State's Kevin Lavery's been following this. Kevin, it would seem Fort Custer has a very good chance of being selected for this mission.
To be sure, Mark, Fort Custer is one of four sites the Pentagon is considering. At one point, there were about 450 possible locations on the list. This process has been underway for a couple of years now. The goal is to build a defensive missile battery that would shield the eastern half of the United States. There are already some similar facilities on the West Coast, namely in Alaska and California. Michigan is competing against sites in New York, Ohio, and Maine. If it's built here, it's estimated it will create about 300 jobs directly and more than 1,000 indirect jobs. So I spoke with Congressman Fred Upton by phone just after his tour, and I asked him what makes Fort Custer an attractive choice.
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, the Pentagon did an initial culling of their potential sites. The Defense Authorization Bill requires that missile defense sites be established to look out over the north and the eastern part of the United States. The western part is already covered. And so the Pentagon called the list. It was larger before. It is now down to four sites, of which Battle Creek's one of them. And it's literally a $3.5 billion construction development site. We have a lot of advantages. One is the community support, certainly the congressional delegation. On a bipartisan basis, all of us will be here for another visit in about 6 weeks. But the local legislators, the county commissioners and others, the governor, Southwest Michigan First, all been very active in promoting the site, which is a good thing, as it does count. Gets points, has merit. As the Pentagon narrows its selection really to one site, which will be done before the end of next year.
So we must really be close then, because there were about 450 potential sites when this process first began, as I understand.
Well, there were a lot of sites, even within the Battle Creek site. Frankly, there are two sites within Fort Custer itself, but they know that there's one site that is better or will score better than the other site. But literally, we're down to Maine, New York, Ohio, and Michigan, and we're the only site here in Michigan.
Well, ever since 9/11, America has been very focused, of course, on counterterrorism planning, which seems to be on a smaller scale than something like what Fort Custer would be repurposed for, an intercontinental ballistic missile attack. Not to downplay the importance of a site like this, but it does seem that this is a bit reminiscent of an older threat, of a Cold War-era threat. How is Congress assessing the need for this facility based on the type of threat level that could be in play?
Well, language has been put into both the House and the Senate past versions of the Defense Authorization Act. And we know that North Korea, we know that Iran, obviously Russia, I mean, they all have they don't have it already, capabilities to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles. This would be a defensive site, no testing done, no warheads here. In essence, it's bullet to bullet, I guess you could say. But it is something that matters as it looks to the defense of the United States, which is why it has enjoyed bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate.
We're talking with Republican Congressman Fred Upton, who represents Michigan's 6th Congressional District. He and a number of other officials, including Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters, support a plan to create a missile defense site at Fort Custer, an Army facility near Battle Creek. Fort Custer is also being viewed as a site for a new cyber protection squadron. This does sound like 21st century warfare. How would that be structured? What's the cyber protection squadron?
We actually have some cyber capabilities now at Fort Custer, so this would expand that use. Part of it is we have a very educated workforce here in Southwest Michigan. In fact, the studies by the Upjohn Institute have shown that we have perhaps as many as 26,000 folks within a geographic region, a veteran with some cyber security training, interest, right levels of education that would be eligible for this. And we've got a top secret facility here. We looked at it a little bit today, and it'll be something that the entire delegation looks at when we come back September 2nd and 3rd as a congressional delegation, really looking at all of our military sites, defense sites within the state, Camp Grayling, as well as the eastern side of the state, as well as here in Battle Creek.
And again, to further explore that point a bit, what would a new facility with more emphasis on cyber protection offer that perhaps is not already there in place at Fort Custer?
Well, this would enhance what we have already and expand. You know, a cyber attack is what we saw probably from within the last couple of weeks. We know that this is a new weapon of choice, and it's something that we have to absolutely be on top of. And that's why we continue to push for cybersecurity, and not only, you know, for protection for our defense installations, but also for the general public as well.
Certainly, I imagine that your colleagues in the other states, Ohio, New York, and Maine, who are advocating for their sites, have their say as well. Are you hearing a lot of opposition to a planned facility at Fort Custer? Are there people who say this is just pork, it's expensive to build, and might even set us up in West Michigan as a potential target?
Well, we believe that this site is very secure. We've got some tremendous advantages that perhaps the other three states in competition do not have. We've got a major interstate literally adjacent to the site. We have a 10,000-foot runway that is being maintained, and again, language in both the Senate and House Defense Authorization Bill maintain that. Again, that's a real plus. Quality of life, people that actually want to live here in Southwest Michigan, is a huge advantage. And on the political side, you've got Republicans and Democrats united together saying that this ought to be the site. We've got a number of buildings that are already in place where they can marry together the components to build as many as 30, 40, even 60 different defensive missiles. And remember, there'll be no warheads here. That's not the purpose of a missile defense site. It's literally a bullet hitting another bullet that may be coming our way. So we have some real advantages and cost to the taxpayer as well. The land is pretty much cleared, and it's ready to go. The security perimeter is there, and you've got a workforce that is ready to go at it. And we think that with all those factors, we have a very good leg to stand on as we get down to the close of the competition, which will be announced by law before the end of next year.
Right, because as I understand, right now we are nearing the end of an environmental impact assessment. Is that the phase where we are?
That is correct. That is correct, and that'll be done this fall. Comments will be asked. It'll become finalized early next year, and a decision probably announced either mid to late summer next year. Ultimately, it has to be done by January 1st of 2017.
So you and your Michigan colleagues then have your work cut out for you in terms of keeping this on the radar, so to speak, of our new Defense Secretary Ashton Carter. He's only been on the job for about 4 months, so keeping this in the forefront of his mind seems to be one of your priorities, I would think.
Well, it is. And the other thing is, you know, it is unprecedented that our delegation, all of the Republicans and all of the Democrats are going to take 2 days together later on this summer to visit each of the defense installations within our state. I don't think most states have ever done that either. So we're going to look at the advantages, what's going on, how we can help each other, and obviously look at this site as a real potential, knowing that it's going to get built somewhere in America. We think that we have the advantages, and frankly, the taxpayers ought to be behind us, too, in terms of what we do.
We're talking with Republican Congressman Fred Upton of St. Joseph. He represents Michigan's 6th Congressional District. When you were in Battle Creek, Congressman, you also toured the VA Medical Center. The issues facing the VA are many and complicated. What are some of your impressions of what you've seen in Battle Creek in terms of patient care, in terms of handling this backlog we've been hearing about in cases over many years?
Well, you know, it's always troubling, the statistics that came out from the VA the last 2 years about some of their facilities around the country. The good news is that in Battle Creek, we haven't seen that. It's really pretty good in terms of wait time, in terms of professionals there willing to take care of our vets. I know for me, literally, I say this all the time, the easiest vote I ever cast is a vote in favor of our veterans. And the Michigan delegation, we're fortunate to have a facility like Battle Creek. They've done some major renovation expansion. They're looking to open up a major new mental health facility literally in the next couple of months. Senator Stabenow and I toured that today, 1,500 employees at this particular site. We want to make sure that our vets are taken care of and taken care of well.
Congressman Fred Upton, a Republican representing Michigan's 6th Congressional District, he and Senator Debbie Stabenow have recently toured the Fort Custer Army facility near Battle Creek, as well as the Battle Creek Veterans Administration Medical Center. Mr. Upton, thank you so much for having time for us today.
You bet. Thanks, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
WKAR and Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. Lansing's Impression 5 Science Center is planning a new $450,000 exhibit designed to make a big splash. It's a two-story permanent water park that will combine play with education. The project has received a $250,000 commitment from the Rotary Club of Lansing to mark the club's 100th anniversary, which is next year. Impression 5 is a hands-on learning environment which opened back in 1972. The center serves over 120,000 families and visitors each year, offering kids and families activities that encourage risk-taking, problem-solving, and team-building. A few days ago, Current State's Peter Wharf caught up with Impression 5 director Eric Larson at the center.
It's a building that was originally constructed as a wagon factory in the 1800s. So it has this beautiful brick and wood infrastructure.
Seeing some of that now in your offices on the first floor.
Yeah, this is what the whole building is built of, this beautiful kind of sandstone brick, pieces of timber that you actually can't get anymore, right. This old growth timber. And what we like about that is that those materials make people feel comfortable, as opposed to concrete, steel, and glass, which are a little colder. Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to do in our vision for the building was to, as to the furthest extent possible, find a way to kind of bring back the historic, if you will, elements of the building, because we feel that that provides a nice, comfortable space for families to visit. And then, of course, update where we needed to create kind of creature comforts and accessibility. So about 7 years ago, we started revisioning Impression 5, and we did that by taking a really hard look at our product. And we defined our product as our educational programs, our exhibits, and our facility. And we did a SWOT analysis on all three of those things. So we identified our strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats with all three pieces of our product. And as you can imagine, identified some things that we needed to fix quick, fast, and in a hurry. So we created a new vision for our exhibits. We knew that the reason people are coming to Impression 5 is because we have exhibits for them to explore science. So we need to make sure that our exhibit inventory was relevant and dynamic. So we looked at all of the things we offered on the exhibit floor and decided, first of all, that we needed to shift our target audience away from just fourth graders on school buses coming to visit the state capitol.
Right.
Because while that's a big piece of our attendance, the larger piece of our attendance is families.
Right.
And families are coming with babies and toddlers and 12-year-olds.
So a wider range you're looking to explore.
Exactly. And the exhibits have to be built in order for a multi-generational group to engage within that work. So that means that we had to change everything. Because no longer was it okay just to have these kind of standalone tabletop activities that were focused on fourth grade curriculum. Right. We needed to create environments where families could play with science together, create new ideas and things using science together, and challenge the understanding of science. So as soon as we defined that, we started to put together the plans on what we were going to do.
Right.
What does that look like? So that's where we see the massive change in the exhibit inventory.
So you've created larger areas that include water, that include light, that include building, that include sounds.
Correct.
The senses.
The senses. And that's what Impression 5 was initially named for. That's what the 5 refers to, is exploring science with 5 senses, or as many of those senses as you have.
Another of the new things that's happening at Impression 5 is that partnership with WKR Radio's sister station, WKR TV, and Curious Crew.
Yes, so this is a really neat partnership. Often, we've always kind of toyed around here with creating some type of broadcast presence in doing science experiments. We just never had the capacity to do it. And so when WKAR created the Curious Crew and asked us to be a partner, we thought it was a wonderful opportunity. So I believe this is the second year in which we're filming episodes of the Curious Crew right inside the Science Center, which means we set up an actual studio, if you will, right in the main exhibit floor on Mondays. And we film, or WKAR films and produces, a really fantastic show focusing on science with kids. They've done a great job. They've put a wonderful cast together. To be honest with you, really all Impression 5 is doing is providing the space, and it makes us look really very good.
It does look good, and that's a huge part of the contribution is the set itself, everything that people see on the TV show. Tell me a little bit more, speaking of new projects, about the recently announced water room that will be coming. Can you share sort of the genesis of that and also maybe some of the larger concepts?
Sure. The two-story water room, the new water room project, which will open in the summer of 2017, is really, it's kind of the culminating piece of us reinventing our complete exhibit inventory. When this exhibit opens, we will have replaced 100% of the aging exhibits within the last 7 years, and that's a staggering statistic. It's well over $1 million in investment, all coming from local foundations and corporations that have decided that they want to invest in their science center. And when we went through the visioning for not only the exhibit projects and the educational programs, but for the facility, you know, the building we're in is fantastic, but we are a little limited because the ceiling height is only about 14 feet. So when you're trying to do something super dynamic, or you need some high bay space, we just don't have it. So one of our kind of lofty goals that we had put on the post-it on the wall was find a way to create high bay exhibit space. So we currently have a water room in the Science Center, which is popular, but it doesn't really fit the new Play Create Challenge standard or benchmark. Right. And so we had put that on the list of things we want to reinvent. And the great thing about the current location of the water room is it's actually in an overhang that's kind of cantilevered over the side of the building, and there's nothing below it except for open air. So we've got a great opportunity to enclose that space, cut a hole in that roof or floor, if you will,
right.
And create, instead of a 14-foot clearance, we'll have close to 30 feet, and will give us an opportunity to create some really dynamic water demonstrations. And things, what I mean by that is, you know, we want to have a 30-foot Archimedes screw that allows a child to actually transport water like they would in a third-world country after having to drill down to find the water. Then we want them to use, you know, two-person piston pumps and big cranes and davits, things that will be kind of monumental or lifetime, life experiences that they'll remember for a lifetime.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Executive Director of Impression 5, Eric Larson, in downtown East Lansing, and we're talking about some of the history and upcoming developments at Impression 5.
I'll lead you through here. Okay. We'll go into this kind of weird storage area, but this is the exterior wall.
Oh, yeah.
You can see the old historic penetrations.
Yeah.
And we're going to open this garage door. This, if you come out here, so we just walked through the center of the building. We're now outside underneath the overhang, the existing water room of Impression 5, and looking out to the east across Museum Drive. This natural archway, take the garage door out, this will be the entryway into the new water room.
Right.
There's another natural archway there, which will be another egress point. Along this I-beam right here, there'll be a wall that will be installed, and it'll go all the way out to the sidewalk here.
Right.
Then it'll turn north, go all the way up to the northeast corner of the overhang, and return back to that brick wall. And this whole space,
right,
will be the first floor of the water room.
So this has got to be 3,000 or 4,000 square feet here.
This, yes, it's, I believe it's about 3,500.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good size space. These walls, the one that's east facing and the one that's north facing, will be full storefront, meaning all glass. Which you will see. So the first time you come down Impression 5 or turn down Museum Drive, you're going to see an active, vibrant, dynamic exhibit space. And when you make that turn, you're going to know you've made the right decision. The biggest complaint I've heard right now is that people are starting to do the math, like, well, how old are my kids going to be when the water room opens?
Right.
And they're like, well, my kids will not be of Impression 5 age anymore. Don't worry, there'll be plenty of things for them to
right.
do.
That's the thing, when you sort of expand the age appeal of the museum itself, you know, appealing to families with kids maybe from, you know, toddler to 12 or, you know, tweens or early teens, those kids will be coming longer. You know, they don't outgrow the museum quickly.
Yeah, that's, and it, really that's, I mean, from a business standpoint, you know, we have to think about our meaningful product and who our target audience is, because to be honest with you, Impression 5 isn't funded through, you know, municipal tax funds or any of those pieces. We have to create a product that people are willing to pay for. And so the strategy that we've created to do that is to make sure that we are focusing on the family, which means you have to have spaces for your infants or a little older than infant. We've got that in our first impression room, you know, kind of birth through four. The rest of your exhibits need to include things for kids maybe up to 12 or 13 years of age to do. And what that does is it gives us an opportunity to really create kind of this experience where people feel like they're in their science center. You know, a child gets to spend 10 years of their life coming to Impression 5.
Right.
That's pretty significant. They only spend 12 in school. So if we can get them for 10 here, we're going to do well.
There's always a lot going on here at Impression 5 in downtown East Lansing. I've been talking with Eric Larson, Executive Director of Impression 5. Eric, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you for your interest in Impression 5 and giving us an opportunity to share the story.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And coming up on Current State on WKAR, a West Michigan park gets some help keeping invasive plants under control from some roaming goats. Current State's Melissa Benmark will explain. Plus, for years, the Michigan Shakespeare Festival has brought fans of the Bard to Jackson. This year, the schedule adds performances in Canton in southeast Michigan. Current State's Scott Pohl talks with the festival's artistic director, Janet Blixt. That and more after the break on Current State. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft is still millions of miles from Pluto, but in a week to the day, next Tuesday morning, 7:50 a.m. Eastern Time, it will be within 8,000 miles. And with the technology that exists today, that means photographs of Pluto that will tell us much, much more about the little planet or pseudo-planet, whichever you prefer, than we've ever known before. Kenneth Chang in the New York Times writes that images from New Horizon have already revealed the unexpected. A dark region at the north pole of Pluto's largest moon. Usually polar regions are bright with ice, not so on Charon, Pluto's largest moon. Pluto also has a series of black spots on its surface, including a string of them, each about the size of Missouri, that the scientists have nicknamed brass knuckles. It is not out of the question that Pluto could have erupting ice volcanoes. Weather patterns could actually swirl in Pluto's atmosphere of nitrogen and methane, and it could even have haze and even, get this, snowfall. Snowfall on Pluto is not completely out of the question. New Horizons was launched back in January of 2006, 9.5 years to reach Pluto. It travels at 31,000 miles per hour. We'll learn a lot more beginning about a week from today. So it's summer. You're talking with friends about lawn care, and some joker inevitably says, why don't you just get some goats to keep the weeds down? Well, a West Michigan park system is doing just that. Current State's Melissa Benmark joins me now with more. This is in West Michigan. Melissa, what's happening?
In Ottawa County, the park system there has hired a team of mostly young goats to keep down invasive species in the wilder areas of their parks. We're talking about things like oriental bittersweet, but also poison ivy, which is not an invasive but is getting increasingly aggressive. And for more on the Goat Brigade and what they do, I talked to Melanie Mannion, the Natural Resources Management Supervisor for Ottawa County.
We started last year after our MSU Extension's Master Naturalist program did some research and developed the program for us. And we had gone to other places such as Wisconsin and Chicago to look at what they were doing and brought it back to start managing some of the invasives that we had at our park.
Wow, so this came partially from MSU. I did not realize that. How many goats are there doing this?
This year we only have 8. Last year we had anywhere between 12 and 14.
And tell me about the goats. Like, how old are they? Do they have names? What were they picked specially for being a particular breed? Or what's kind of the background on the goats?
Sure. This year, they're young, actually. They are all, 6 of them are 10 weeks old, and then 2 of them are 10 years old. And the 6 that are 10 weeks old, we got because, believe it or not, it was very difficult to find goats.
Really?
It was. We wanted to find 6 goats from one location because we, for health purposes, we, you know, to minimize the amount of chances of spreading disease or whatever, and we couldn't find 6 goats from one location. We were told we need to put an order in earlier in the year so that they were ready to go, but by the time we started looking in February, it was too late. And then the 2 older ones are actually on loan from one of our partners from Ottawa Conservation District, and they're kind of the babysitters, and they keep care of the 10 little ones and protect them from predators.
So how does this work? I mean, do they just walk around the park at the same time as people are there and eat the various plants that you're trying to keep down, or how does that work?
Exactly. So they're out there in an electric fence. So there is a portable battery and a portable fence set up, and there is a weak charge that goes through there that keeps out predators and keeps the goats in a contained area. And in that area are the invasives that we want to be managed, and it keeps them out of areas that might have sensitive species or species we don't want them to eat. And then we have signs throughout telling people to stay out because we obviously we don't want people touching the electric fence, but also the goats are eating poison ivy, and we don't want them touching the goats and coming in contact with the oils that will cause the rash from poison ivy.
I didn't know they could eat poison ivy. That's crazy.
Yeah, they can eat a lot of things that we can't tolerate even touching. So they have a they have one of the largest livers, and that liver allows them to break down toxins, and they can eat amazing things like roses and, you know, such as multiflora rose and barberry, things that, again, we wouldn't even touch.
So basically, it's kind of like having, like if you had a maintenance crew or a construction crew, you kind of block the area off and the goats go in there and do their job, and then and people stay out, hopefully. And but do people come to see the goats? I mean, have they become part of an attraction, or are they kind of just quietly behind the scenes cutting down the invasives?
You know, we have a lot of volunteers that are authorized to go in, and they help care for the goats. So those people are very attached to the goats. And but we do have a lot of visitors. You know, we haven't this year yet, but last year we had regular visitors that would come out and just watch the goats for entertainment because they're kind of funny, and they're very cute.
I know that goats have a reputation for being kind of playful and also sometimes a little bit too smart for their own good. So you haven't had any trouble with them outsmarting the electric fence or getting into places that maybe they're not supposed to be or that kind of thing?
No. In fact, we have boar goats, which are infamous for not staying contained. And, you know, a couple times last year, it was obvious that they had gone through the fence. But because they're herd goats, they naturally stay together. And so they just immediately went back into the fence and just kept eating because they stay where their water and where their shelter is. So it wasn't a problem, and we do regular checks. So twice a day we're out there making sure that the fence is live and that there are no issues and that the goats are safe. Again, we do that with volunteers. And so, you know, we just immediately realized that there was an issue, put them back in the fence, and everything was fine.
So where do the goats go in the winter or in bad weather?
Well, in bad weather, they do have a shelter there. So it's just basically a tarp, and they go hang out underneath that. But a lot of our experts that we've talked to said that goats are very tolerant of all different kinds of weather. So that's, you know, kind of a luxury for them. And then as far as for the winter, two of the goats, are on loan to us, but the others, they're actually meat goats. And so the whole point of this is for agriculture, that this is a partnership between not only the conservation of our natural resources, but also agriculture. And we are, these goats will then go back to the farmer at the end of the year and most likely will make a wonderful meal for someone.
I know this is a trial program. The current crop of goats then not likely to become full-time employees of the county anytime soon?
No. Well, you know, we are very fortunate in Ottawa County Parks that we do not have a lot of areas that are so overrun with invasives that we need to have goats. It might be something that periodically we would have to do to just kind of maintain these certain areas, but most of our areas are too high quality that we wouldn't want goats in there. But we really wanted this to be a model that other people could use. We know other parks departments have looked at this and are considering using this on their properties, and a lot of people have interest in this for their own private property. Amazon, actually, you can rent a goat through Amazon.
But you're kidding me.
No, but at this time, there's nobody in the Midwest doing this. So we would like to be a model that some business could hopefully take and run with, and they could go on Amazon, and people could, you know, rent a goat to come deal with their poison ivy. But because we couldn't find anyone in the entire state of Michigan when the Master Naturalist did the research, we couldn't find a single person that did this in Michigan at this point. So we had to take this on ourselves. But we really hope that this would be, you know, become a business.
So basically, the you're looking at the potential of there being folks who license out sheep to whoever needs, you know, some extra vegetation taken care of.
Exactly. And this is done a lot out west, and it's just not done here in the Midwest. So, again, Amazon does this. If you go online, you know, you can find somebody in Seattle or California that would do this. There are other companies called EcoGoat that do this. But just in the Midwest, this is a novelty. It's just something that we haven't really utilized, and yet we have a growing market for goat meat. It's a sustainable, locally grown, organic meat. So, to me, it's a win-win. You're dealing with an environmental problem, aka invasive species, and you're providing a locally grown, sustainable meat source.
Any thoughts of using sheep in a similar capacity?
The research actually shows that sheep are very good at like herbaceous materials, so wildflowers basically and grasses, whereas the goats are good at woody materials like vines and shrubs and trees. And the particular invasives that we're wanting to target are vines, things like poison ivy, oriental bittersweet is the one that we really want to deal with, and multiflora rose. And so because of the particular kinds of plants we have, we chose goats.
Just to go back to the very beginning of this idea, I'm trying to imagine the meeting of Ottawa County officials where the word goats first came up. Were you at that, and what was the reaction like?
Well, actually, the way this all started was I had gone to several training sessions at national meetings. So the National Parks Association and a couple other meetings where I had seen experts from around the country that talked about using goats for natural land management. So basically managing for invasive species. And I thought this was such a great idea since Ottawa County has such deep roots in agriculture. I thought it was a win-win, and it was a way to bridge the two, you know, basically communities of agriculture and conservation. And so when I brought it back, you know, I brought it back as saying, hey, you know, this is a great way for us to reach out to our agricultural roots and address this in a cost-effective way. And it was not a difficult sell at all. They were very interested in it because, again, it's cost-effective and it works. And there's a lot of good science behind it, too. But the actual development of the plan was done by the Master Naturalist through the extension.
Well, Melanie Mannion, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and I hope that some of your listeners can come out and actually see the goats.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And this environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. The Lansing State Journal's Judy Putnam writes today that the owners of a beautiful horse in Clinton County believe that fireworks may have spooked the animal a week or so ago, and Phineas, all 1,000 pounds of him, has not been seen since. Phineas has a striking white mane, and Judy Putnam writes that Phineas lived near Price Road, about 5 miles east of U.S. 27. On Saturday, a farmer on Chandler Road, about 5 miles south of there, says he or she found white mane hair caught on a fence around his or her property. As of today, that's the best idea we have of where Phineas might be. He's been gone about a week. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. Big changes are afoot at the Michigan Shakespeare Festival this year. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on what's going on this summer at the annual Jackson production. What's on the playbill this year, Scott?
Well, Mark, the festival is staging A Midsummer Night's Dream, mm-hmm. Henry IV, and Richard Brinsley Sheridan's The Rivals. The big news, though, is that the festival is branching out from its base at Jackson College's Bauman Theater. After 2 weeks there, the festival will wrap up its schedule at the Theater of Cherry Hill in Canton. I talked with the festival's producing artistic director, Janice Blixt, about this year's shows and the reasons for splitting the season between Jackson and Canton.
The very simple fact is we are the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, and one of the things that we noticed in our audience surveys over the years is that more and more of our audience was coming from outside of Jackson and outside of the area. And more were starting to only come for one show instead of all three. And so when we began asking, hey, why is this? What's the case? We would put on all the surveys. Why did you choose to only see one or three? travel and distance tended to be the biggest answer.
Hmm.
So when we were looking at our demographics and who sees our shows, we realized that we would be able to open and run our shows in Jackson and hold on to our core Jackson, Lansing, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo audience, and most of Washtenaw County still, at our Jackson location. This way, we're also able to be in Wayne County. It was a decision that was made based on our demographics and the future of the festival. When it comes to audience building, we are in a situation where we were kind of hitting the ceiling. Jackson County itself has 160,000 people, and whereas we love each and every one of them, Wayne County has 1.1 million people, not including Detroit. And in the Canton location, we're also connected to both Macomb and Oakland. So for the future of the festival, for the sustainability of the festival, for the financial life of the festival, we knew that we would have to expand outwards. There were a lot of questions about, and there's still a lot of questions we're getting about, why are you moving? We're not moving. We love our location. We love Jackson. The Bauman Theater is a terrific place to see Shakespeare. We are not moving, but we are expanding. And there are conversations that are being had right now of the possibility of further expansion in the future. So that's kind of where the decision came from and why.
Those out-of-towners who were traveling to Jackson, mm-hmm. Did you have information that led you to feel that they were coming from, say, suburban Detroit, that
yes,
area?
Yes, we have a pretty large group, a subset of our audience is coming from what they've listed as either Southfield or they've listed themselves as Oakland County.
Mm-hmm.
And it is suburban Detroit.
Those people who only came to one show as a result of distance, perhaps, mm-hmm. Did they come for the main show? Like last year, I seem to recall it was Hamlet. Is that
it
the show they
be, yeah.
came to see, or
it
did they come
to
see
be.
The other shows?
Right. It was actually kind of a funny breakdown where I would say, based on our demos, we had about 70% of those people were coming to see Hamlet, the big mm-hmm. show. But the other 30% were a rabid sort of, I've never seen Cymbeline, and
right.
I'm going to see it, kind of an audience. So it didn't break down easily along those lines, but it we did have larger audiences for the primary, the first show that opened.
We're talking with Janice Blixt, who is producing artistic director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. Their season opens with preview performances on July 9th at the Bauman Theater in Jackson. The thinking tends to be one big, everybody does this Shakespeare play every mm-hmm. season, one less frequently performed Shakespeare play, and a third play written by someone else, perhaps inspired by Shakespeare or Shakespeare-like in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
What are your selections this year?
Well, this year our big flagship show, it's the way we refer to it, is A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a wonderful, funny, wacky, magical show, and we're just doing it that way. We're doing it as a fun, romantic, magical show. And then our lesser produced is we're doing, actually, this is the first year we've done anything like this, a big combo platter. I have taken Henry IV Part 1 and Henry IV Part 2 and put them together to create Henry IV.
Wow.
We're really impressed with it ourselves.
Does this mean a really long program?
It actually doesn't. It started out at about 7.5 hours worth of text. And this will run a little, it'll run basically around 3, which is the same as Hamlet, Richard mm-hmm. III. So that's the way that show is working out. The key on that one was deciding the story that I wanted to tell. And the story that I wanted to tell was the father and son relationship between Henry IV, who was Bolingbroke, and his son, Prince Harry, known as Hal most of the time in the show, who will end up being Henry V. So their relationship and how they come to terms with one another is the center point of that production.
Hmm.
So anything that didn't lend itself nicely to that or to the Civil War that was raging at the time, because got to have that, anything that didn't lend itself to that is pretty much gone. So that's our second show. And then our third show is Richard Brinsley Sheridan's 1775 comedy, The Rivals. And this is your show for absolutely wacky, silly comedy with people in giant costumes and huge wigs and all of that fun 18th century, I was going to use the word hijinks again, shenanigans, actually, is the way the director of that show, Robert Kozlarik, who directs for us a lot, he's been referring to it as 18th century Georgian shenanigans. So, and it really is. It's a lot of fun. It takes place in Bath and London, and it's about people who think they know what they want in terms of love and realize that that's not really what they want. And so, again, it's a happy, funny, silly show.
With regard to the Shakespeare shows you've chosen again, are you doing traditional stagings in terms of the time frame in which we see the story, or have you modernized either of them in any way?
Well, in order to tell Henry more clearly, we are doing it period. We're doing it, it's basically 1412, 1413, so early 15th century. It's got that late medieval quality to it. But we're also, in order to take an epic show of this size, where it's a little more theatrical. It's not realistic. So there's very visible lighting and there are visible theatrical elements that help keep the story moving forward quickly and help keep the production on track. So it's got all the wonderful broadswords and costumes and lush look of that, but it's also got a kind of hyper-theatrical black box feel to it. A Midsummer Night's Dream, what we ended up going with was I really wanted the fairy world to be, the shorthand we've been using is Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, the elves, the wood elves. That's kind of what these fairies look like. And we sort of built the production around that. So it's when we're in Athens, it's modern dress. It's very current day. And then when they go into the woods, it's very magical. And this is the phrase we've been using constantly, because now you're into the woods.
I have one more question about choosing the rivals. And that is that in past seasons, that third play has been something like The Importance of Being Earnest, which has an appeal of its own. Mm-hmm. People are familiar with it. They may not be interested, frankly, in Shakespeare, but they are interested in that. Choosing The Rivals by Richard Brinsley Sheridan, a lot of people, frankly, have never heard of him or this play, I suspect. What was marketing in any fashion a part of the thinking when choosing this play?
It was. The Rivals is considered kind of part of the classical canon. It is not as well known as something as The Importance of Being Earnest or when we did Pygmalion. But we've also done She Stoops to Conquer by Oliver Goldsmith, and it was a huge hit. It's part of what can loosely be termed the classical theater canon. And yet, I also think it's important to produce things that people might not have seen before. The Rivals is the kind of show that you might have read about in a review of some production in the 50s in London, or you might have read about in theater history and you haven't seen. And one of the reasons that I like doing Shakespeare is I like producing it for people to show them why 400 years later we're still doing it. I also like pulling out some of these other shows that are really wonderful but might not get produced as often because they don't have that immediate name. It's one of the things the Michigan Shakespeare Festival can do that a lot of other theaters can't, simply because our audiences have come to trust us and have come to get used to the fact that we're not out to put up something incomprehensible. We're not putting up something that is a museum piece or a relic, but we are trying to bring life to things, to productions, to shows that people might not have seen before or can't be produced in some of the smaller theaters. The Rivals, again, it's a giant show. So unless you've got a budget to make that happen, unless you've got the size of the company that we do, unless you've got the background in classical theater, a production like that is really hard to produce. So again, we like kind of feeling like we're serving a niche, we're serving a purpose.
Well, here's the important thing we need to make sure our listeners are aware of, and that is that the Michigan Shakespeare Festival will be in Jackson for only 2 weeks this year, weeks one and week two. Begin on July 9th. After a week off, 3 weeks at the Village Theater in Canton. So you're starting at the Bauman Theater in Jackson, then moving on to the Village Theater in Canton. Janice Blixt is producing artistic director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. Thanks for bringing the festival to our Current State audience.
Thank you again for having me. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for Tuesday. Tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment highlights Camp Liberty, a spot in Jackson County where veterans can go to enjoy nature. The idea is that being outdoors helps veterans struggling with post-traumatic stress. Also, literature can be a window into the history and culture of the place where it's written. You have the brooding landscape of Southern Gothic and the upbeat adventurousness of Westerns, but what about Michigan's own literary identity? We talked to freelance journalist Anna Clark about her new book, Exploring Michigan's Literary Luminaries. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery was our director today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, and Drew Hill. All the latest Current State editions can make it to your smartphone. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. On social media, we're on Twitter at KAR Current State, and on Facebook, just search Current State from WKAR. It's always great to hear from you. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.